Started those discussions afresh this week.
Yes.
I've been reminded of the memorandum that Peter Farmer's file earlier in the piece, which we're digging out and we're planning on discussing as council at lunchtime, and I'll come back to you after that. We did have, we thought maybe at that point we'll have a better idea of when this week we might be including the evidence and therefore whether there is time later on this week as opposed to another hearing week. So that's some of what we're thinking about, but obviously it depends on the speed of progress and when the court had in mind to do that site visit.
Well, at the rate things are going, we would expect the evidence to be concluded sometime tomorrow.
Yes.
There are certain things that we have discussed that we would like to see that readily located for us, such as Formula Wetland and some of the lower Waikato areas. The real issue is how far upstream or into the forests people would like us to go, and whether there are any ways to assist us in covering the distance that might be required, so that we don't. I mean, we have, as I say, we're not going to need the scheduled fifth hearing week. In the sixth week, we've got the return date on the 5th of December. So, if we were to do it, we're probably looking at, is it the week of next week, effectively, when we might tour around.
Yes, next week is the fifth, isn't it? So
the fifth week, so. Which I don't think we'll need for the hearing of any evidence.
Your Honour, I only have a problem with that because I've got a lot of reason to do it.
Yeah, no, I mean, when I say a week, I don't think that we'll be touring around the catchment.
Even all day may cause me a problem.
And the other thing that, in terms of timing, is how soon people think they may be able to provide us. If they wish to present a closing of any kind, when they'd be able to provide that, and whether there ought to be any staggered dates in relation to that, so that you might have the opportunity at least to see the closings of other parties before you prepare a document that might be filed with us. But that could be sometime in the week of the 27th.
Yes, the timing that we've been working to there is to be able to file or circulate to the parties an updated set of
provisions
by the end of next week. Mm-hmm. Mildly optimistic that we might be able to circulate that sooner, but we'll have a better idea by the end of this week. And then I had in my mind the week after that, Friday after that, which would be 20. be forward for parties other than the regional council to file written closings, and then the regional council's written closings with the final set of provisions Friday after that. So that's conceptually what I've got in my mind. Obviously, if we can give parties longer to look at the provisions we've filed, that might help them.
Mm-hmm.
If they can give us longer to look at their closings, that'll help us and may enable us to get ours in sooner. So, obviously, in your hands as to whether there's directions that relate to those dates or whether we confirm that in the next week or.
I suppose that only gives us a couple of days to review your submissions before the actual presentation of closings on the 5th.
I'm conscious of that, sir, and I'm also conscious that for that date of the 5th, I think you'd signalled you wouldn't want parties to take you through the legal submissions, but you'd want to signal questions you had, or at least signal who you had questions for, and I don't want to cut you short in your preparation time for that.
Mm.
So that's why at that date needs to come back a little bit, then perhaps some of the other dates come back a little bit as well to enable that.
I don't know that you'd be anticipating any surprises coming in the closing to other parties. I think it appears to us that the issues that are before us are clearly identified. It's not to say that they're easy, but they're at least reasonably clearly identified.
Yes, and to a large extent, and helpfully so, other parties' legal submissions have made it clear what the issues are and may well reduce the need for lengthy closings from them, other than simply confirming what parts are still outstanding. So obviously that's a matter for them, but the more efficient we can make that process, the better.
And just coming back to site visit or visits, just a reminder, I'm sure with experienced counsel you all know that it really will be going to places to illustrate things that might not be clear to us from the evidence that's presented during the hearing, as opposed to a tour, and waving the flag in various places. We sometimes get cases where, particularly perhaps where lay parties are presenting, where they seem to feel that unless we visited each home, we don't have a full understanding of the resource management issues affecting the region. So, all right. Well, we'll leave you to do that. As I say, at this stage, it may be that we have a sort of a concluding conference at some stage tomorrow and try and resolve these various matters. But in the meantime, does anyone else wish to be heard about that overall program? No?
Sir, I just wanted to confirm that the date for the closing is on the 5th, that ABL will be available.
Yes.
Yes. We're outside all the time.
Yes. The hearing for that week was scheduled to be in Auckland, so we will be in our own courtroom number 1, which has the full AV facilities. I think we'll use MS Teams.
Oh,
do the VMR see that? No. But in any event, yes, you'll be able to zoom in or VMR in without any problem. As Mr. Conway has indicated, and I can confirm, our expectation at this stage will not be a day of presentations. It will be more of a conference with questions and answers. And although there needs to be some structure so that we don't just run around in circles, it may well be that we proceed perhaps issue by issue rather than party by party. But that may well depend on what emerges from the way in which parties choose to put closings in front of us.
Yes.
Does that assist?
It does. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Sorry, on
that issue, sir.
Yes.
I have some housekeeping matters. There's obviously some outstanding paper that needs to be provided to the court in relation to my submissions.
That's
not stage, Mr. Cooks. Yes.
Will it be prior to your presentation or after?
they weren't prior. That's my intention. But I am just following the CMI submissions.
Very good.
Which isn't quite the order in which I intended to be filing, but
that's all right.
It's the way it has transpired. I'm also filing because I thought it would be of assistance to the court rather than doing things on the hoof, as it were, with Mr. Bright, Mr. Lowe, and Dr. Jose, which is Dr. Jose and Mr. Lowe have got some supplementary comments reflecting on matters that they've heard and observed through the transcript, and I said that it would be critical if they put those in writing.
Yes, it would. Thank you.
Mr. Bright has been beavering away, he said, in a evolutionary, not revolutionary manner, and has done some work, further work, in trying to do two things. First, have a go at perhaps simplifying and tidying up Schedule C, which has been a moving piece of technical work. And secondly, building on the trajectory and trying to complete the matter related to the trajectory, insofar as it relates to funding for conceptual land, he has had an attempt, which is open for consideration and question and comment, of making some amendments that go between policies 5.18 and a new discretionary rule. That try to provide some better connectivity and provision for some feelings to land and address this issue of retention of passive hearing and the lack of nutrition in that and the offsetting compensation kind of death knell that seems to face the land use change in that regard. So he has done some drafting in that respect, which we will talk to.
So this is in relation to the issues that have been identified with Rule 9.
This is correct. This
and
is
having
right.
A non-complying threshold.
That's right. I have had some discussions with my friends and jury to see if we might have end up on a common sheet of paper in that regard, and we probably aren't quite. Unless I don't want to preempt what is position might be, but I suspect we are proposing a discretionary rule and he may suggest that it should be a restricted discretionary rule and make some difference between us around the additional matters. But
subtle difference,
yes,
that's
subtle difference, that's right. And I think as I said to him, it's probably helpful for the court to have both for consideration. To a lesser or greater extent, depending on what it says. So that's housekeeping issue number one. In relation to my two submissions, I'm going to retire, so I need to address some matters in relation to that. I don't have questions for my witnesses this morning.
Right.
I have just sitting here received a message from Ms. Robson, who's the sole CNI witness, who thought she had a cold last night and was now tested positive.
Oh.
Which is, we don't really have a plan B for that in this venue, unfortunately. She says she's feeling relatively well considering, but obviously she's not coming in here, I suspect.
No. well, thank you for alerting us to that. Can I just inquire, Mr. Conway, would you like to have questions from Ms. Robson?
Yes, I have questions that I intend to ask in the circumstances subject to court's preference. It may well be that I can address those matters in closing if there's to be no issue raised by my friend as to the lack of challenge in cross-examination. I don't imagine that'll be an issue. So
yeah, well, that often happens with planning evidence and plan change cases. The boundary between submission and evidence is blue.
So I'd be content with that. If that was the only reason we were going to come back for another day, I think that would probably be that would be wise to simply deal with it that way, from my perspective at least.
There's potentially another way to deal with it, Mr. Ferguson, for questions to you in writing.
Yes, and I think she would be content with that. already making some supplementary comments, and I was going to suggest you put those in writing. She asked her some questions, but I think she has little choice now but to put them in writing. So I think that's one option. There were, what I had asked, because I thought it would be of value to the court, because there's a little bit of a gap in terms of some of the detail about the CNI land holding, so there's a lot of the work that was done before through the Series G process, focused largely on the my freehold land holdings. And she was expecting to obtain today two maps, one which shows the CNI forest land by Harvest State, because that's quite relative. So when things come online, given that the CNI actually can't do anything until the forests are harvested and they're unencumbered by the CFL that's in there. And so that would be useful, I thought. And secondly, she also has one that I think breaks it down by LUC class as well, which I couldn't find anywhere in the material. I think it's such a recently generated map. So, but again, once I get those, I can see if they can come to anyone in case the questions arise after that. And if there are other information requests that might arise in relation to CNI.
Do you have any objection if Mr. Conway or others were to make submissions in relation to Ms. Robson's evidence without having put the matters to her in cross-examination? In other words, the ruling, whatever it is not strictly to.
Personally, no. I might wish to give some instructions on that.
Well, you should check. As I say, you may wish in seeking those instructions to note that from the point of view, much of what planning witnesses may be saying could amount to or could be treated as submissions on the text of a plan. And that in other courts, the point would be made that that is a matter for submission rather than evidence strictly. But yeah, please, if you would seek those instructions.
I think it's a fair observation, particularly in regards to.
Particularly in this case, I think. Let me just check. Are there any other parties who, where counsel were intending to cross-examine Ms. Robson, who would be concerned if her evidence were received without an opportunity to cross-examine her? No? All right. Well, Ms. Long.
Sorry, sir. I don't have an issue with that at all, and I'm quite happy to address that matter at legal submission.
Yes.
I just wanted to raise another issue, and Mr. Ferguson did flag with me the supplementary evidence that he planned to file. So I wanted to address that. The evidence of Dr. O'Say and potentially Mr. Lowe, I would like the opportunity to talk to threshold experts at Fish and Game about. So I haven't had the chance to talk to Ms. Ferguson about when we're going to receive that and if it's going to be before cross-examination. Thank you.
Well,
and I'm not sure what it contains.
Well, indeed. I strictly, Mr. Ferguson, it may well be that your friend could argue that leave would be required for those statements. So, firstly, the sooner that they're able to be made available, and secondly, if there are issues around any party's counsel wishing to either brief witnesses or take further instructions, we'll need to give them a little bit of time in order to do that and see where we go. I'd like to think, given the what from the court's perspective has been the highly cooperative approach that's been taken, that you and your friends can work that out. But if there are likely to be problems, do alert us to that.
Yes, I'm about to extend so that
very good.
There's a temporal aspect of it. They were matters that I would reasonably probably ask questions by way of supplementary question. And I think having scanned
I have no doubt that the evidence will be relevant, so it gets over the first hurdle. The second question is whether or not it is new in the sense of being something that people could not reasonably have anticipated, or at least in the subject people could not have reasonably anticipated. I don't think we've seen anything like that. If they are, as you say, Mr. Brock's statement is evolutionary rather than revolutionary, then I hope we can accommodate that.
That's right. I think certainly in Mr. Lowe's case, he brought in some discussion on slope maps, etc. He had a very good example from Stoutland where applying a LIDAR analysis relative to the MV slope map showed a stark differentiation in the slope for that, which I thought was a useful additional information, which would be of value to, I suspect.
Maps are only slightly less wrong than models.
Yes.
So, again, in terms of, they're tools, and the question is how useful they are, and the idea that any particular technology will give you something perfect, I think needs to be kept at bay. But is the information useful? To what extent do the identified discrepancies throw the whole scheme, the whole framework of the plan into question, or to what extent do they demonstrate that some residual discretion or power of dispensation needs to be retained?
Mm. And I think it's intended to go more to the probably reinforcing the solutions being in that there should be scope to look at better maps than the MV's flight map if they are available, and I think that plays a favourable into those that have got a map from MV that says their entire land is low slope and they really know that it's not.
Will do.
Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you. Anyone else? Alright, let's continue with the case for horticulture in New Zealand.
I call Andrew Barber. Can you please state your full name for the court?
Andrew John Barber.
And in this appeal, have you prepared written statements of evidence, rebuttal evidence, and participated in and reported on the expert conference and a joint witness statement?
Correct.
And in doing all of that, did you comply with the code of conduct for expert witnesses?
Yes.
And are there any corrections you wish to make to any of your evidence?
There's one small correction to make. So in the rebuttal evidence on paragraph 13, it refers to 60% of growing land that should be 70%. That was correct in the standard evidence, but incorrect in that time.
Okay, so it's just a typo. And once that correction is made, do you confirm that all that evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and ability?
Yes.
excuse it. Just had a small number of supplementaries included in our topics about the gap and so on.
Thank you.
So, of course, you had an interesting. The first thing I was going to ask you about, Mr. Barber, is your evidence addresses the risk assessment tools and scorecard that you've been developing. Can you just, in a summary way, update the court as to the latest developments with where that scorecard's at?
Yes, so the scorecard has been progressively worked through and is now the form that was presented in the format was presented in the my evidence has now been updated.
Oh, that's the documents that we're going to come to. Okay. And you might have heard yesterday reference being made to something called an SVS project. Is that something you know anything about?
I know a little bit about that. I'm the program manager for the Sustainable Vegetable Systems project.
Mm-hmm. And so what in essence is that project all about?
The Sustainable Vegetable Systems project is a four-year multi-stakeholder project, industry-led, primarily focused on nitrogen management. The key outcome or output from that program is a decision support tool, which I'm happy to explain further. But the decision support tool is around nitrogen decisions making.
Okay. And you said it's multi-stakeholder. Who are the stakeholders?
Already called out on the stakeholders are NFE, Horticulture New Zealand, Potatoes New Zealand, Vegetable Research and Innovation, and all their groups of product groups.
Right, so is it specific for CVP?
It's actually specific for CVP.
Right, and it's a project with a four-year time frame to stay, so what kind of stage in that timing are we at right now?
We are now at year 3.5, so we've got approximately 6 months to go.
Okay, and what's your assessment of how that project's gone so far?
I would have been on slightly biased, but it's a significant step forward in nitrogen management of vegetable crops. The real key aspect of nitrogen management is understanding how nitrogen flows through the system. And this program puts that into context of what's occurred before the crop, so the previous crop, what's occurring now, what's occurring in the bottom crop. Absolutely crucial because unlike some other systems, vegetable production is incredibly complicated. And so there's many levers that can be pulled, and this tool is a decision support tool. It enables people to have discussions around the table around how that nitrogen is flowing through the system, and consequently the decisions that can be made about that. The significant step forward, I think, with this particular tool is that it integrates soil nitrogen testing. Soil nitrogen testing, by far and away, is a measured number, right? It's a measured number. Everybody needs to have a model. We're all looking at the future, right? So you need a model. But a measured number beats a model number every time. And this tool puts that measured number into the decision making process. So, yeah, I think it's a difficult and advanced step forward.
And in terms of participation levels with this project, what are they like?
Yeah, so part of the research are our research provider. And being a grower-driven, grower-centric project, it is has lots of grower involvement. The tool is absolutely grower-centric, and I underline that, you know, that decision support, like that's absolutely what it's about. Quite frankly, we spend a lot of time discussing models, and it's practices which the environment sees. Practices is what the environment sees. And this tool very much is practice focused. The practice of developing a nitrogen budget the practice of soil testing and overriding a model assumption with actual numbers of what's happening.
And I'd like to just turn to...
just before you do, Mr. Barber, can you just tell us then, so what form does this take? Is this a document, a guide to be followed, or is it software to be managed, or is it devices for like isometers and so on for testing? What's involved?
It is a online web app, so it's live right now, albeit in the process of change, because it's kind of the next 6 months to have some really good feedback and improvements too.
And the measurement mechanisms, the measurement tools, what are those?
Yeah, so like I said, I think that is a significant step forward, is that it integrates soil testing, right? And so kind of when I refer to the model, everyone's going to have a model, right? But what's actually happening in the paddock at the time is the measurement. So
are there fixed isometers on each farm?
No, actually not. So what it is the soil testing is going into the paddock, taking soil samples, like growers do university now. And a significant step forward for this is it's nitrogen focused. And so I can say that there's a whole lot of different forms of nitrogen that flow through the system. And this tool picks up those different forms through the soil test that we're taking. And you'll see there's multiple ways of doing a soil test. We're kind of in a quite unique situation right now, that a whole lot of things come together. There's new testing, so there's a thing called a hot water test that plant really developed. Pretty new, does mineralize again, really exciting. That's come along the last few years. There's a mineral N test called the quick N test. Again, pretty new. Take it in under isolation, kind of meaningless, but put it into this tool and you see it in context, right? And the whole thing is seeing it in context. Because when you see the answer in context, you then can make a decision.
You're basically saying that you're covering total nitrogen, there's nothing that can be getting out there that you cannot take into account, is that correct?
So when you say total nitrogen not getting out there,
you mentioned the various forms of nitrogen, so you're making sure that you're capturing all of those different forms.
Absolutely. So, I don't know. There's a diagram in my evidence that shows the nitrogen flying through the system. So we have this thing which is total nitrogen. It doesn't matter if it's vegetables or pasture, it doesn't matter. There's total nitrogen in the system. And 98% of that is not available to the plants. 2% of that becomes mineralized and becomes plant available. So this hot water test that I referred to determines what that mineralizable rate is. And then you've got mineral N, which is the amount of ammonium and nitrate in the soil right now. And there's another test, that quick N test that I referred to, or the lab test that does those. So they are essentially the three forms that we measure.
Thank you. Now, you would have heard yesterday inquiries made about whether documents in support of the GAP, the EMS add-on, checklists and so on could be provided. We've done that because I'm an out of towner. I haven't been able to print dozens of copies, but I've emailed it to the court and to my learned friends overnight. And just to address the court before I ask you a question, there's four documents. Mm-hmm. Three of them are the regulatory sort of material, the GAP and so on. The fourth is a series of a few slides that Mr. Barber's prepared, and I would think that might be the most efficient way for him to explain those three rather voluminous documents. That's how I'm proposing to do it.
Well, we can bring that's item four of our presentation. We can bring that up on our screen.
I think that would be good. And then I think while he's explaining it, he may need to go through back to those documents 1, 2, and 3, because they're the actual documents, which I think is what Paul was interested in. So Okay.
But all parties should also have a copy of
all
the documents and the slides for the presentation.
That they do. So three documents and then the slides are the fourth.
Thank you,
sir.
Should we do that now?
Yes, so if you can have those open, and then I suppose to put it in evidence, I'd better say, are you aware that four documents prepared or provided by you have been circulated to the court and the parties?
Correct.
And the first one, the NZ Gap ENS add-on audit checklist?
Correct.
Is the second one the NZ Gap EMS farm environment plan template?
Correct.
Is the third one an erosion and sediment control plan for a stylized farm X?
Correct.
And then is the fourth one a series of 14 slides that you've prepared drawing on your evidence?
Correct.
I'd like to produce those four exhibits as Horten Z exhibits 1 through 4.
Yes, that's done.
Thank you. And what I'd like you to do, Mr. Barber, if you can, is starting with your slides, can you just briefly present the high points or significant elements of those three documents? And as you do that, can you please feel free to refer back to document 1, 2, 3 and just try and educate us a bit about what those documents show?
Happy to help.
And sorry, for the record, when you change slide pages, can you just tell us what page you're on?
Okay, I'm on slide 2.
Mm-hmm.
Freshwater farm plans in NZGAP ENS. This refers to my statement of evidence in paragraphs 14 to 17 and paragraph 21. So in those paragraphs, what I'm referring to is the audit, NZGAP audit checklist. So the audit checklist is the standard. That's what the auditors assess the growers to. So the ENS, Environmental Management System, is an add-on. The growers to follow, I'm sure, can describe the NZGAP system equally well. But it's been a system that's been in place for many, many years and primarily driven by food safety. That's where it came from. The ENS, Environmental Management System, is called an add-on because it's within the structure of the NZGAP program, but it's an add-on, it's the environmental component. And so the checklist that I've got on page 2 and is document 1 is the standard that growers need to achieve to pass the ENS. I personally find it helpful to have work examples. So what I've picked out on slide 2 is two questions. The first question is, and this is a question to the growers by the auditor, has a risk of nutrient loss been assessed? And the answer simply is yes or no. But in answering yes or no, the grower needs to produce evidence of that. And the evidence costs of that would be, having completed, in this case, for example, the under this assessment in the NZGAP template, which is the second document.
Sorry, so that's exhibit 2. Is the template you fill out as a grower, and that would be the evidence and support to satisfy the auditor's demands for verification.
Absolutely, because with the ENS, it is, and this is referred to in my evidence, it is built upon a risk assessment, and I think I'll kind of emphasize, we'll come back to this quite a bit, I suspect. It's a risk assessment, and the thing about this assessment, it ensures that the mitigations that we do are proportionate to the level of risk. So the question here is, has there been a risk assessment done? And the template, Exhibit 2, has that risk assessment in it. Keeping in mind that the nitrogen or nutrient risk assessment in the template was prepared in 2019, and please move on, things have been approved. The risk assessment that's now been improvement upon the risk assessment that's in the MCGM, and that's the evidence that GRI would produce to have done that risk assessment.
The question I had.
Yes.
The risk scorecard is based on the same starting point, is it, but improved? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Keep in mind, a risk assessment is exactly that, right? It's not a pass or fail. It's the idea is that things bubble up so that you identify the highest risk, and that's what you focus on. There's multiple ways of doing it. I personally think the risk assessment that's been produced as part of this course work and climate change and horizons is a significant improvement on what we had in 2019.
Okay, so that in terms of slide two, the summary is there's a lot more requirements, but this is just a couple you've plucked out to illustrate your point.
Yep, absolutely. So that's the question that they get asked. They get asked, has a current nutrient budget been prepared? Again, a question, but what sits in behind that question is the need to produce the evidence. And nothing stands still. The S program has has got the ability to reduce these nitrogen budgets, and that's the evidence that a grower would show to the auditors as well, so that question.
Okay, so that's slide two.
So in answering that question, if we move to slide three, please.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is covered in my statement of the evidence, paragraphs 14, 17, 21 and 23. What the question that the auditor asked in the checklist was, has a nutrient budget been done? The template, which is what the grower uses to help answer those questions, is the question, and that was, nutrient applications are informed by available information or fertilizer recommendations. It's cut out essentially. So those four boxes are yes, no, or yes, partial, no, and not available.
I'll just pause you there. Sorry, because it is inadvertently cut off. Can we maybe go to the exhibit where we can see it in the speech? So what exhibit number would that be?
Okay, so we can please go to paper 2.
Yes.
The
EPP template.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it'll be page
13.
Well, I can. Exactly. Page 13.
Okay.
So
if you go through maybe a work example for us.
Yeah, if you scan in that example, number six, so the list of whole lot of good management practices. And at planting, one of those good management practices is nutrient applications are informed. And in this case, the grower's answer yes. Equally, they could have answered partial, no, or not applicable. I think the really, really important thing about farm environment plans is it's not stating that you have to be at good or best practice on day one. But if you are answering yes, then you need to show evidence to prove why you answered yes. If you're answering partial, then you need to add into your action plan, how am I going to move from partial to a yes? And that is absolutely where I believe the power of a farm environment plan comes. We've got 19 pages in that template. The absolute power of farm environment plans boils down to the last page, which is the action plan. Again, I'll reiterate what I said before, the environment doesn't see models and discussions in courtrooms, it sees practices, and it's the practices that are picked up in that action plan that the environment sees.
Is that at 10A, the very last page?
The very last page. That's what it falls out to. The final page is the list of actions. To get there, you say in that comment section what you're going to do. If you stand down on that, where they've filled out, fill things out, those actions, whether answered partials or no, will be reflected in the
yes. Okay. So if you go back to your presentation, that was slide three that we were illustrating.
Yeah. checklist that the auditor asked the question. The grower has, before the audit, completed the template because that guides them, and it's essentially a roadmap to answer that question. And the evidence in this case would be the use of the SES tool to show that they've taken into account information or have got fertilised recommendations that are appropriate.
Right. So with the evidence that you produce to this auditor, is it or isn't it supported and behind with the documentary record?
Yeah.
It is.
100%. So what sits in behind the ability to answer those questions is industry developed codes of practice, and I think the court's seen a few of those in the last or certainly yesterday. So what sits in behind all of that information is years of research, prior experience, and in this case it's come together as the SDS.
Great. So you've got your template, you've completed that, you've got your evidence and support, and then what did you want to talk about
here? If we can please go to the next page, which is page 4 on the slide, which is the assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And this refers to my statement of evidence, paragraphs 39 to 52, and also appendix 1 and 2, where I've got the assessment scorecard with I think a helpful good example.
Yes.
What I'm emphasising here is the risk assessment is the first step in a farm environment plan. And what I've written there is implementing meaningful action. That's what we're here, that's what the environment sees as meaningful action. Mm-hmm. The risk assessment is the foundation for that meaningful action.
Yes, okay, thank you.
The next slide, slide 5, is it's got multiple names now, the nitrogen scorecard, the nitrogen risk assessment tool. But essentially, what's presented here is an example of risk assessment. Do you want to step through what the work example
is? Yes, please. Maybe just pick, one item to talk us through if that works on that section.
A risk assessment for nitrogen use is as the risk goes up, i.e., as more fertiliser is applied, then you need more and more mitigation to offset that risk. It's a risk. It's not saying that's what's leaching or that's what's going to become unreleached. It's the risk goes up, but the risk can be managed by increasing the mitigation. So the work example there, this is based off it's been developed with a group of expert caucusing as part of plan change 2 and testing with growers. So what you'll see essentially is that as the quantity of nitrogen applied goes up, the points in the score and the score increases.
Mm-hmm.
If I refer to this in appendix 1 and 2. If you wouldn't mind moving to slide 6.
Yes.
So this is where, in the scorecard, mitigations offset the risk. And in the current practice, in this work example, the grower doesn't have a nitrogen budget and is doing testing on part of their land once a year. So consequently, they've got a reasonably high score, right? And again, the emphasis with the farm environment plan is we're not punishing people for where they stand today. We're putting in place the roadmap for where they go to in the future. So then you'll see to the right of that slide is future practices. So in the future, this particular grower will implement a nitrogen budgeting. And keep in mind, I really, really think nitrogen budgeting in the soil test is the two key elements for reducing nitrogen optimization, and consequently nitrogen optimization means reducing nitrogen leaching. So in the future, this grower is planning, and this will be in their farm environment plan, or in their action list, to have a nitrogen budget. And so consequently, that reduces the risk of that, and so then they get a negative 50 points. The other key practice that this grower will implement is they'll do testing, nitrogen soil testing once a year for part of their land, and at the beginning of each crop in this example. And so again, that brings down the risk score, and you have various thresholds. But in this case, it was 40, and you can see their scores now come down a negative score. But again, the main point of this is to have directed mitigations. So your direct mitigations are proportionate to your level of risk. Had that grower had a much higher fertilizer application rate, then they might be doing nitrogen testing before every fertilizer application. But if the quantity of fertilizer applied was less, then the risk is less, and they don't need to go to that extent of testing for every single application. But that's the real power of these tools, is that the mitigations are proportionate to the level of risk.
And just so I understand how this works, so there's 40, and you're saying 40 is the number that has what been determined as the thing you have to reach. Is that the same? Is that universally applied? What's the sort of significance or genesis of that 40?
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
I don't understand. I suppose, is that just an example, or is that an actual number?
So the target was established in expert forcing group with regards to plant change, and it changes depending upon the context. So in different regions or in different areas, that number might move around. It might be 40 in one spot, it might be 65 in a higher range or higher risk area. Lower and higher rate or higher risk areas. But keeping in mind, not getting hung up on the number, because the number is the way you drive mitigations, right? It's the way you determine the proportion of mitigations.
Right. And is that why you, in the last slide, said, look, the number is unitless, I think you said.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Am I right? I'm sorry to summarise it and tell me if I'm not putting words in your mouth. But is the idea that you really just need a number which is a yardstick. If you're over the number, it's a sort of relativity tool, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Again, keep in mind why we do risk assessments and scores is to ensure that the mitigations that we implement are proportionate. We have in some environment plans, we refer to, and you'll see this in my evidence, a toolbox of mitigations, and that's absolutely what the NZ Gap EMS has, is a toolbox of mitigation. You will see in that template, there are a whole lot of good and best practices. That's not to say that every single good and best practice needs to be implemented. It's a that's in the toolbox. And in my situation, in my paddock, this is the tool that I'm using. And the other ones I might use in a different situation, but I'm not using example mitigation A. I'm not using this paddock because it's what's it.
Yes. Okay.
Can I just
of course.
This number of 40. If you set that for the first year, after 5 years of monitoring, you find that there's still elevated nitrogen in the groundwater or something. You could move that down and require adjustments to go to a lower number.
I'm sure you could, but it's not that the dots aren't that joined up, right? We're talking about an extremely complicated system.
Yes.
In my mind, the practices that we are advocating for, which is particularly in nitrogen, with regards to nitrogen, is nitrogen budgeting and soil testing. We are working in an environment that is changing all the time. And I just think it's just not that joined up to say, if I do this, then I'm going to see a change.
I was just being hopeful.
We all live in hope, right?
Okay. So that was slide 6, was it?
Yes. Yes.
And what did you want
slide
to discuss next?
If we wouldn't mind moving to slide 7, please.
Oh, yes. Is this the same yes that I asked you about earlier, this 4-year project?
Absolutely. It's
okay.
I got all the industry and our stakeholders questions. Statement, this refers to my statement of evidence, paragraphs 26 to 37.
Mm-hmm.
And as previously referred to, this is where you break it. Can we please go to slide 8?
Oh, yes.
So again, I included this in my evidence, albeit it was quite a small picture.
On your written statement, it's already in there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. What is this trying to depict?
This is the absolute nub of what we are trying to understand. Vegetable production systems are extremely complicated, and so what this is trying to show is the nitrogen flowing through the system. Unlike pasture, which is reasonably steady. What happens in the vegetable production system is that on the same piece of land, the crops are constantly changing. So the previous crop has an impact on the current crop. The following crop can be chosen, or the selection of the following crop can be determined by what happens now under the current crop. So what that diagram is trying to depict is, and I referred to it before, the total end. So if you have a look at the yellow text at the bottom, that's the total quantity of nitrogen in the soil, and it's a massive amount of nitrogen, but it's not mobile, it's locked up, and 98% of it can't be reached.
Can't be what? Well,
can't be reached. Plants can't access that total nitrogen until it becomes mineralized, which is the yellow arrow. So that's the mineralized end portion. And if you remember, I referred previously to the hot water end test,
mm-hmm.
which is now integrated into the sustainable vegetable systems tool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a reasonably new test. It's a test that's been developed by Plant Food Research. It's been tested. It's now available through the labs. But it determines the rate at which N moves from that yellow total N pool into the mineral N pool through the mineralization. And that's determined by a whole range of things. It's determined by temperature, by soil moisture, lots of variables change that from day to day. That test is fundamental. What you'll see in white is the mineral N. So the mineral N is what the plants can take up. So the mineral N is taken up by the plants in the form of nitrate or ammonia. That's the pool that we try and manipulate. The fertilizer, of course, is supplied, and that becomes released and is available to be under the plants.
Mm-hmm.
If we move our eyes to the right, what you'll then see is crop residue. So not all of the crops that are grown are harvested. So some of the crop remains on the and remains intact. The whole range of things. It could be the carrot tops. They get chopped in the paddock and left in the paddock. It could be some broccoli is left behind because as customers you and I demand to have a perfectly sized broccoli head, and if it gets too big we don't want to buy it, so we have to leave that in the paddock. All of those forms of crop residue, crop nitrogen, will become available to the following crop at some point in time. And that's what's depicted by those yellow lines under the right. It's the crop residue breaking down and becoming available to the under the plant. Look, that's an area, if we think about it, that's an area that has massive variability. It's an area that definitely will have more research put into it over the next few years. But quite an exciting aspect to consider.
Mm.
And then you'll see the red is nitrogen leaching. So that's invariably often the nitrates that leach up below the active root zone. And what's not shown on here, that there's also platelization. So nitrogen is lost through platelization. And then crop residue and the whole thing carries on here.
Okay, and so if we take into account what you're saying about the various types and the complexities of nitrogen in the vegetable growing context. Can you tell us how that links in to the SVS program, perhaps on the next slide?
Absolutely. If we can please turn to slide 9.
Yes.
And this is referred to in my statement of evidence, paragraphs 26 to 37.
Thank you.
The point that I made in there was that nitrogen optimization is driven by quite a whole range of things. It's driven by cost. We've heard an awful lot about the cost of nitrogen. It's obviously driven by yields, and it's definitely driven by quality. Put too much nitrogen on and your crop bolts, and nobody wants to buy a crop that's bolted. The point there that I make, and I've emphasised, is that I believe we are in a position right now where we are replacing our fixation on nitrogen leaching numbers with practices. And again, I think I've mentioned it a few times, but as much as we want to sit here and debate the numbers about what the nitrogen leaching might be, that doesn't change the outcome of the environment. What changes the outcome of the environment? What the environment sees is practices. And this tool drives, in my opinion, the two most significant practices, which is nitrogen budgeting and as we mentioned, integrating that budget with the soil test. So my last point there, I talk about a measured number every single time beats a model number. Mm-hmm. And that's what this SVS tool delivers.
And these two, as you say, most important or major developments, the nitrogen budget tool and integrating soil mm-hmm. testing, are those kind of things that we hope will be usable in the distant future, or are they available now?
They are available right here, right now.
Right.
I think we're in a real, really good period right now. A whole lot of things, not probably by design, but by luck, have come together. Mm-hmm. We've got access to different soil tests, and we've got a really good platform for discussing nitrogen budgets. And again, that's where I think a lot of the improvements will come.
Okay, thank you. And what about the next?
Okay, so if we can please turn to slide 10, and again, this is in my statement of evidence, paragraphs 26 to 37. This is what the SVS project has and is delivering. This is a nitrogen budget.
So where is this screenshot taken from?
So this is online right now. So this is I'm not brave enough up in the court to bring it up live, but this is a screenshot taken from the tool that is available online.
Okay. And can you just again in a summary way teach us what it's depicting?
Yeah. The approach that we've taken with this tool is how do we develop a tool that becomes business as usual for growers? How do you create a tool that isn't quite frankly brushed off once a year when the auditor turns up, but is part of ongoing business? And that's I believe where this tool works. It's in that space of decision support. It's in that space of this is what's happening now, and it supports those decisions. The way you get a decision support tool to be built into business as usual is you reduce the number of barriers to its use to as well as you can. So the approach that we've taken is we've got a basic level. So what's the absolute minimum number of inputs that I need to put in to get a budget going? And the example I've got there, you put in there as a carrot, you put in when you planted it, you put in when you harvest it, and what your intake level is. And out of those four or five inputs, it produces the graph to the right, which is the nitrogen budget. And the nitrogen fertilizer guidance, in this case, is 4. And again, I underline the word guidance. It's the real power of these sort of decision support tools is its guidance, and it creates a point of discussion that you would have around a table of the grower owner and his trusted advisors, you know, his agronomists, had the base for a discussion, which is really, really where the power of the store comes in. If we can please move to the next slide.
So observers are very told, I just need to take a short adjournment.
Absolutely. Yep. Thank you.
This is what a nitrogen budget is, and the real power of a nitrogen budget is that it creates the basis for discussion. So, like any budget, it's what's coming in and what's going out. So what's coming into the system is the amount of mineral nitrogen that's already sitting there. There'll be some organic mineralization, there'll be the fertilizer, and there'll be the crop residue from the previous crop. What's going out? At the end of that crop, there'll be some nitrogen sitting in the soil. At the end of that crop, you have to have some nitrogen sitting in the soil at the end of that crop. If you don't have any nitrogen sitting at the end of the crop, then you're one rainfall away from a crop falling over. Crop falls over, we're in major financial problems, but we're also in we've also got other issues to deal with that we can't get off our crop off. You'll see on the output says there's losses, in this case 20 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. There's a whole lot of nitrogen in that carrot that's exported off the paddock, so there's 88 in this case kilograms of nitrogen in the carrot crop, and there's nitrogen in the residue, so there's nitrogen in this case in the tops of the carrots.
An undefined amount. It's very small, but what's that made up of?
It's others and ogres, we're not talking German, you know, the drums.
Are the losses the leachate losses?
Yes, a combination, correct. So losses are a combination of losses out of the system, both leachate and lateralization.
Just before you go on, one of the issues that I've come across in other cases is that the more nitrogen you've got in the soil, just sitting there, when you get a very heavy rainfall, there's more chance for the nitrogen to get up. Would you like to comment on that, please?
Yeah, you're 100% right. The only way nitrogen leaches out of the system is if it is in a form that can be leached, i.e. nitrate, and that there is water moving through the soil profile. So,
in your system, how does that change the risk of nitrate loss? Using this balancing system.
Absolutely. So what it does is, I talk a lot about it turns the invisible, because you can't see nitrate, right? You can't see it. It turns the invisible visible, and this tool which makes that nitrate, those flows through the system invisible. How it optimizes that nitrogen is exactly what you've just gone and done. I've never presented this graph to a group of growers and not had the old but or the questions you're exactly asking now, right? That is absolutely what leads us into level two. And level two is, how do I integrate this example into with my soil testing? And so the soil testing in your example was, if it was elevated, then I can either delay my nitrogen application or I can pull back. But seeing it in the budget and integrating that in the soil testing, which actually then allows the conversation in real time to happen. If we turn to the next slide, I've got an example of exactly that. So we can please turn to slide 12.
Well, yes, because it's potentially mineralizable.
Potentially mineralizable.
Okay.
So the example here was, and you'll see, it's exactly the same crop, but we're now taking into account the potentially mineralizable end. So the grower's gone out, they've conducted this new hot water test. And what you'll see on the right is that the components of inputs for organic have gone up, and the fertilizer guidance has come down to account for the fact that actually there's going to be some mineralization. And that, if you like, free nitrogen will turn up, and consequently the guidance on how much fertilizer needs to be applied has come back. I think the really, really important point here is the discussions that we have around that. So the mineralizable N component, which I referred to in the beginning, is changes, it's variable. A model is an average. What happens in practice is affected by the climate. Not on average, but affected by the climate that's happening. Happening right there and now. So if it was warm and wet, then the mineralizable component will be higher. If it's colder and drier, then there's less mineralization. So it's going to be less that nitrogen turn up. Fortunately, we're able to test how much nitrogen is sitting as plant available today with that, with the next test, which is the mineral N test. But kind of what I wanted to, if you don't mind, I just emphasise on that budget, the soil losses, so the loss from either vandalisation or leaching, is controlled or can be manipulated by what we do with the other aspects, right? What we do to the other aspects dwarfs the leaching component. And by that I mean, in vegetable production systems, I refer to the crop and the crop residue part of it, there's all these different forms of nitrogen coming into the system. And by testing and seeing at a budget and sitting around a table, the kitchen table with the trusted agronomists and trusted advisors, we can have those discussions, and I think that's absolutely where the improvements will happen. If we get it wrong, and the nitrogen and the crop doesn't make it to the end, and that's in this case 80 kilograms of nitrogen, that will become available in the soil at some point in the future. So we absolutely have to have a system that tracks that and allows that discussion and ensures, absolutely ensures financially and environment that we get our crop to the end. Keeping in mind that we're getting our crop to the end in an extremely variable climate. Nothing's on average. Which, if you wouldn't mind, if I turn to the next slide, if I can talk to that.
Yes, that's the second to last slide, isn't it?
Second to last slide.
Quick N.
Quick N. Okay. I've mentioned quick N. So, quick N, as previously mentioned, is the amount of nitrate that's in the soil and plant available right now. So, in this example, you'll see that the default number, which in the previous slide was about 50 kilograms of nitrogen, is there at the beginning of the crop. And in this case, the grower has gone out and conducted a mineral N test, a quick N test prior to planting, and actually there is 50 kilograms of nitrogen sitting in the soil, there's about 20 kilograms of nitrogen. Consequently, the guidance around the amount of fertilizer has gone up because there isn't the fertilizer sitting there. I'm sorry, there isn't the mineral nitrogen sitting there to be used. Equally, that can happen the whole way along the crop growth curve. If you took a mineral N test and actually it wasn't, you know, so mineral N is that dotted black line. If there was more mineral N than what the model predicted, let's say it might have been warmer than usual, and there was more mineralization happening and it was more, a notch and then the models predict on average will be there, then you can make decisions about pulling back on how specialised you do. Equally, and if you're applying a growth mindset sort of test, we've stretched in our Auckland at rains. But the crops in the ground, it rains, the mineral nitrogen level might be lower than what the model said it would be on average. Therefore, we're taking a mineral nitrogen test and we adjust what we need to apply to get that crop to the end. Keeping in mind that we don't get the crop to the end, we don't produce a viable crop, then we have a whole lot of nitrogen sitting there as crop that can't be sold and will become available to the soil in time. So we are working in an environment of constant change, and this, I believe, is the power of budgeting. One, it's a knowledge tool for discussion, just like the questions you've raised, and two, we get to replace model numbers with actual numbers, and therefore make decisions around effect by verification, which is only one lever. One context in this example here, there is 20 kilograms of potential losses. Nitrogen losses are happening the whole time. If I do nothing to the soil at all, there will be nitrogen leaching. And we've got that through the Sustainable Vegetable Systems Project trials, where we apply no nitrogen, but you still have nitrogen leaching because it's a natural process. There's still mineralization happening the whole time, there's residues breaking down, they flow through the system, and you've got water. So it happens the whole time. Those numbers, though, are dwarfed by the amount of nitrogen sitting in the crop, which is what we need to, one, sell to ensure that we have a healthy food. But the magnitude is, as you see in that diagram, quite different. I was looking at some results last night of a trial. To put that 20 number into context, a grower cut their cover crop they had and left it on the soil, and in another part of the paddock they did a trial, an in-field trial, and they incorporated a cover crop. There was a 60 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare difference between those two practices. Both fully legitimate practices, 60 kilograms difference. The power of this sort of tool is that then, having now got the results last night, would then sit down to grow and go, well, actually, that's interesting, isn't it? Let's look at things. Let's think about how we deal with that cover crop. Our next crop is still 3 months away, so perhaps we're better off to cut it and leave it on the surface. Actually, we've got our next crop, which will be growing within a month. Let's incorporate that, and we've suddenly got 60 kilograms of free nitrogen.
Yeah, and are those the sort of practices that, do you have a view on whether those are the sort of practices that might find their way into the farm environment plan or not?
But then keep in mind, this whole discussion, right, has been based on a single question in that checklist. The single question of the checklist was, have you done a nitrogen nutrient budget? What I kind of emphasise is that it's a single line, right? But the amount of work and thinking and discussions that goes into that delivering that one line is phenomenal. And that's where, as an industry, we will see that you can't not have discussions around the dining room table and not improve optimisation.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and so that's nitrogen, and then your very final slide is entitled Other Contaminants. And just to move efficiently through that, the first bullet point, Erosion and Sediment Control Plan, that relates to Exhibit 3, doesn't it, for that stylized farming?
Yeah.
And is there something brief you wanted to say about that, bearing in mind it's other contaminants instead of nitrogen?
Nitrogen was a really, really good work example, right? Like personally, I find it really helpful to use a work example, and nitrogen, I think, is a really good example of that. Keep in mind that there's been a wealth of research and guidelines and things developed about the other contaminants. In this case, it's under erosion sediment control. And again, it's one aspect of the carbon environment plan, it's one aspect of the EMS. But what sits in behind it, and you'll see that in Exhibit 3, is this is the plan. So this is the plan. So this is the location of the bumper strips, or this is the location of the several tension points. Again, one line, but what sits in behind that is and so that link there is to the NZ gap.
Oh, so that's the URL there. Yes, and what would the full find there if that publicly available
So again, right back to the whole system, right back to the EMS system. So that link will take you to the those documents that I've got there, albeit clean versions.
Mm-hmm.
And also it is the source of a whole lot of the as we've seen codes of practice. Sits within that website. So keep in mind that these code of practice are the basis upon which we prepare our harm environment plans. If that's the evidence that we have of our practices that are on the internet.
Yes, thank you very much. If you don't mind remaining seated to answer any questions.
Mr. Mitchell, could I just ask one more point?
Please do, yes.
On your slide 13, you noted the losses there, they're 18.4 kilograms. We see figures, through the evidence, you see figures of 20, 40, 60, 80, 100 kilograms of nitrate leaching. So how much reliance can we put on that figure compared to the other figures that we've seen elsewhere in the evidence?
The thing with the sustainable vegetable systems at all is it is not a tool for determining or modelling the rate of nitrogen leaching. There are other tools out there that can be used for that. Nitrogen leaching is a component. I think it will be a really sad thing if the SCS tool was turned into some way of saying your nitrogen leaching from, in this situation, is 20 kilograms, because it's not. One is variable, one is an enormous amount of uncertainty, and that's really where the power of integrating soil testing becomes involved, because while it's a single number in there or a dotted line, we're actually talking about a whole lot of uncertainty and variability around that. The point is not to focus on that nitrogen leaching number, because that nitrogen leaching number, whatever it is, will improve, and it's only the environment sees the improvement, doesn't see what we think the nitrogen leaching is. The environment sees the improvement. The improvement will happen through the implementation of practices, and the practices are kind of discussed over here today, and sort of.
As you'll understand, the court's most interested in what gets away from the plant rather than in the form of reject rather than product. Based on all the work you've done, what sort of change do you think you might be able to drive in terms of reduction in nitrate?
The power of a tool like this is like I said, is a discussion. So nitrogen leaching is made up of or can be optimised through multiple ways. We've had a discussion about better understanding the crop residue and that breakdown. If you improve that, if you improve our understanding and our manipulation of it, then we're using more of that crop residue in the system, and consequently the leaching will reduce. I gave the example of simple practice between leaving the crop on the surface versus incorporating it, change the amount of nitrogen that's in the soil. There are other aspects that will come along, for example, banding. So there's other technologies, so nitrogen banding. So as opposed to broadcasting nitrogen across the surface, in some situations it's appropriate to band it on bed. Then immediately you've got a reduction in total nitrogen use because you're not putting it in the in the wheel ruts and things like that. So there are ways that will reduce nitrogen leaching, but knowledge, budget, soil testing, banding, banding and fertilizer, timing. And none of these things come free. So banding, I think, is a classic example of where around placement that will get improvements. It doesn't come free though. You can, when you band fertilizer, it takes considerably longer to do it than broadcast. So you've got more staff, you've got more equipment. And so again, it's an initiative.
I do understand those things, but in a very basic sense, we've been told that nitrogen has to be reduced by 37% over 8 years. Can you make some comment on what you think might be achievable from CDP over, say, the next 10 to 20 years? Is that a realistic expectation that there could be a 37% reduction?
I believe through budgeting, soil testing, fertilizer techniques, we will see a reduction in nitrogen leaching, driven by optimizing nitrogen use. The leaching will be reduced as a consequence of those practice changes, not because we're focused on whether the numbers are 35 or anything like that. Keeping in mind in this case here, in this particular case, it was 20. 35% of 30% of 20 is 6 kilograms of nitrogen.
Well, roughly
6 kilograms of nitrogen. One practice, you know, the practice of measuring in that Cobrezio example captures it at a difference of 50 kilograms. Just the way you treated that crop residue.
But very simply, do you think, what sort of percentage do you think might be possible over the next 10 or 20 years? It's just not possible to say.
It's not possible to say, but I absolutely hear today saying you cannot, nitrogen leaching will not increase and it will decrease simply through discussions and actions and practices. If it 20% is it 4 kilograms or 6 kilograms, 20% or 30%, I think it will be. It can't not be reduced by optimizing having these tools we have available to us. It will be driven down. But keeping in mind, driven down by not being as a consequence of the actions that we're doing, not as a consequence of modelling it for the next 30 years.
Thank you. Well, if you could stay there and answer any further questions anyone might have, I'd be grateful. Thank you.
No, sir.
Yes, thank you, sir. So I'm a lawyer for DOC, and so I've got a few questions mostly around the mitigation measures and those practices that you refer to, taking your point that it's about the practices and on the environment that count. So that's where my questioning will focus mostly. But before I get there, I just had some questions on your rebuttal first. So with regards to your rebuttal evidence, if you could have a look at paragraph 16, please.
Yes.
So you raised concerns there, understandably, regarding the Director General's evidence, I suppose, around the impacts of the setbacks that the department is seeking in relation to CVP. And so, and you've gone on to say in there that there was no evidence to support those setbacks in relation to CVP. And so, I'm assuming based on that comment, you've read the evidence of, in particular, Ms. MacArthur.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we could go there, just so I could point out what I consider to be evidence that she has provided, and just get your views on that. So, her evidence is behind you in the 320 series, the grey of grey volume. And tab 5 of that, please. And so, you go to page 23 or at the 0281, would that under? And page 16, well, actually, we start at page 22. And so in the paragraph 66, she refers to cultivation and CVP setbacks. And so, acknowledging the relief that the Director General is seeking there, she's gone on to say that the council evidence proposes to exclude commercial vegetable production from setback requirements, and then there is no evidence to support to suggest CVP contaminant losses to water are any less than cultivation generally. Would you accept that? So it's written there, there is no evidence to suggest CVP contaminant losses to water are any less than cultivation generally.
I'm not completely sure what cultivation generally means, but
yes.
that's what you use for vegetable production.
Yes. So you'd accept that?
Yeah.
But both practices require the exposure of bare ground and chemical working of that ground, both of which are high risk practices for erosion and sediment loss that are best managed by a coordinated approach which includes setbacks and riparian buffers. Do you understand?
No, yes, I do, but I don't agree with it.
You don't agree with it?
No, it doesn't need to include a mandated setback. There's a toolbox under Chusong, and in my opinion, that is best selected at the paddock level. At the paddock level, a vegetable buster might well be the best solution, in which case, at the paddock level, with a farm environment plan, you will select a vegetative buffer. That situation might be a low slope paddock with very little outfall and very little channelized flow. Best solution. As soon as you do a risk assessment on a paddock that has slope, you have channelized flow. As soon as you have channelized flow, all the research shows, and just intuitively you know, vegetative buffer. It can't work.
Yes, yeah. And so you mentioned earlier in your evidence just this morning that this should be taken into account as part of that risk assessment.
100%. Yes.
And so, in your experience, is that generally the practice that these types of risks are taken into account at that risk assessment?
Yeah, you've actually got it exactly right. So, the real power of a farm environment plan is what you just referred to as the risk assessment on the paddock. And every case is different. And therefore, based on that risk assessment, you then select the most appropriate mitigation for that paddock. And it could be a bit different.
Yes, thank you. And so I just have to put this evidence to you so I can understand your view there.
Mm-hmm.
So with regards to paragraph 67, the proposed 5-metre setback for cultivation is unlikely to be adequate to protect critical habitat from risk and threaten indigenous aquatic life from sediment. Partly effects on those fish which spawn in the riparian margins of rivers and lakes, including inanna spawning habitats in the lower Waikato River. So Are those types of considerations taken into account, accepting that, like, I understand the channelisation issue and we'll get there, but accepting those, can I just ask, are those types of issues taken into account at the risk assessment stage?
In the newly emerging freshwater farm plans, there is a step on from farm to farm, because it does that catchment context to start with, and I believe that's where that sort of consideration will come into account.
So not at the outset?
Yeah. Well, the catchment context is right at the outset. That's the.
With regards to paragraph 69, Mr. Harper's evidence, she goes on partway through that provision or that paragraph. Ideally, Dr. Woods recommended above, and in the evidence of the Director General's planning evidence, adjacent water bodies in the Waikato, as this would contribute to significant reducing of road contaminants, depending on the slope, as you've seen, overflow in conjunction with other measures. So, I suppose what she's saying there is that in addition to any setbacks that might be appropriate depending on the slope, that could be used in conjunction with other mitigation measures?
Well, you would choose from your toolbox of measures the most appropriate one. You wouldn't, for example, have a 10 metre or a 5 metre buffer and a sediment retention pond, for example. That doesn't make sense. Equally, you wouldn't have if you were going to use a 10 metre buffer or a 5 metre buffer as your recommendation, because the broken was in that situation, then that's what you do. But you wouldn't combine. You wouldn't. And the erosion center control is dictated by, how do I reduce the amount of water coming onto the paddock? How do I erosion control? How do I stop the soil moving in the paddock as much as possible to cover crops? All those things. Sediment control is the last aspect. So at some point in the year, there will be a time when it doesn't matter how good your erosion control is, there will be sediment movement. And sediment control is multiple mitigations. I bet you have bounce strips as an example. A decanting of bun is another example, a sediment retention pond is another example. But you do one of those, you don't do water them. Having said that though, from a farmer's perspective, across the whole farm or a grower's perspective, they might have all of those mitigations, but on the appropriate pattern, but not the three of them pattern.
And so she's also going to talk about critical source areas. Is there many of those on paddocks that you're familiar with? You're familiar with critical source areas?
Well, I'm assuming a critical source area would be concentrated flow of water.
Yes. So we're one of those.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Ponds?
Yeah. Absolutely. In that second exhibit, a paper on the template, the environment plan template, one of the aspects that you need to consider is where's water coming from and where they're going to. Mm-hmm. The going to aspect is reference to your critical source areas. If your flow is generalised, that's a concentrated amount. Consequently, your mitigation options change.
So with those settling ponds, that's been reliant on the bun? It's part of the settling pond?
So sediment retention ponds work by tension. So what happens is that when you have the water flow into the pond...
I might just pause you there, because I've got a document here, which I'm probably familiar with. It might be more useful, because it has some photos and the like of it. Thank you. document, you've prepared it.
Yes,
and so, excuse the photocopying. But what I understand the document is that, as you mentioned, it sets out your panic assessment, so that would be your risk assessment.
Yes.
And then, so this is on page 7 of that document.
Yes.
And then it goes into the implement control measures for stopping water entering the panic, so you go through the whole graph of issues there, and then it's implementing erosion control measures to keep the soil in the paddock. So you've got another, and then at the end there is the focus on implementing control sediment control measures. And so if we could go to that section, and that's section 4 of that document, as you well know, and that's at page 26. So I think in here we'll start with the Bund Act, and that goes to page 28. So you're describing how the Bund functions, or maybe it's the last one, the Earth Bunds, which is the Canty Earth Bund on page 32. So my question really is to recap was the measures of the lines, you wouldn't have a settling pond and a vegetation strip, you normally have one or the other.
Correct.
So a lot of these other measures seem to me to be reliant on a well-functioning or a functioning decanter earth bund of some sort, is that right?
Yes.
And so, if you're able to just talk to that, how that works. Yeah.
So decanting earth bunds or the next step up, which is a set of retention ponds, all work by slowing the water down, and they all work by then having a settling time. So the idea is the water comes into the sediment retention pond, or the decanting earth bund, and it's then slowly drained out. It's a slow draining out which creates the retention time that allows the sediment to settle. 98% of the soil that gets into any of these devices is what we call bedrock. It's the big heavy stuff, right? And it's the big heavy stuff which drops out as soon as you change the soil. The sediment retention pond or the decanting earth bunds drop out the suspended sediment. And it's a suspended sediment which is tricky to deal with, and consequently that's why we need to have that detention time, at that time that allows sediment, that suspended sediment component to drop out of the system. In another project that I was involved in, the Dedicated Waters project, did a considerable amount of work, in this case with NEWA, to measure the suspended sediment and bed load going into these sediment retention ponds and measure the concentration. And on that basis, we were able to determine how large these devices need to be. And you'll see in the guidelines we refer to a half a percent sediment retention pond. By that, I mean there's 50 cubic meters of capacity for every hectare of land, so it's half a percent, 50 cubic meters per hectare. As the area catchment increases, then your sediment retention pond increases because it just, again, needs that time for that suspended sediment component to drop out. From an environmental perspective, it's that suspended sediment part that we are really, that the environment is most affected by. So in the case of a vegetative duct strip, the way that works, it reduces the sediment by essentially creating infiltration. So essentially you've got this channelized flow moving across your buffer strip. A whole lot of that flow gets into the soil. The soil is the best form of filter. And that's the way those things work. Often a misconception is that buffer strips are like an above ground filter. Yes, to a certain extent, but the majority of it is the infiltration of that water in the soil itself, cleaning itself up. And then equally, the sediment retention ponds are the size they are because you need to have time to drop out that suspended sediment, which is the component that we're trying to reduce for the improvement of the environment.
And so you're saying the capacity of these bunds is determined by the catchment area, the size of the paddock. And so, how often do you clean out these bums, and how practical, how does that work?
So the way these bums work is they talk about dead storage and light storage. So you need to have enough capacity in that to take the inflow. Dead storage is the water that's sitting there the whole time. Look, regular maintenance, it depends on nothing's the same, but these cemetery ponds are typically maintained in spring when you can get in there, or in summer when you can get in there and clean them out once a year. If you have a big enough pond and a grower that will appear out and I'm sure can talk to this, if you make the pond big enough, then you might go back every couple of years.
And so with just looking at page 32, at the bottom of page 32, below the photograph, there's a paragraph there, and it talks about the decanting of earth bones and salt traps need to dewater so as to remove the relatively clean water.
Yes.
This is what you've been through.
Yes.
The decanting rate is critical, too fast, and the sediment will have time to settle, slush in and slush out, and
yes.
Too slow, and the primary and emergency spillways will operate. Even moderate size, will not operate, and even moderate size rainfalls, which will also result in poor sediment capture efficiencies. So there seems to be risks there. So based on how regular it's maintained, yes.
Absolutely. In our experience, like a sediment retention pond, that's still sediment one star's job, but needs to be maintained.
So what's involved with maintaining the ponds?
Digging. So you can dewater a sediment retention pond. It'll dry out over summer because it just doesn't have the inflow. Albeit the last summer wasn't really summer. But in general, they dry out over summer. You get in there with the contractor or growers. Lots of growers now have their own excavation and equipment. Dig that sediment out and redistribute it onto the
ground. And so when it does have water in it, and these spillways are supposed to control the overflow, is that right?
Well, there's two spillways. So there's a primary spillway. So the idea is that, you're seeing that picture, photograph 23, that's the water goes into that spillway through the holes. When the inflow is too high, then it goes down the primary spillway. And in a really big event, and you can think back to the Auckland floods, you have an emergency spillway. And quite frankly, once you have an event like that, the reason why you have an emergency spillway is that you don't then destroy your resistant tension pond as much as you have a spillway now.
So in events where high rainfall, as you had earlier this year especially, what happens then if there's low capacity because there's been high rainfall?
Yes.
Does the water go?
In a well-designed sediment retention pond, the emergency spillway activates. Keep in mind that these ponds are designed to accommodate most events, keeping in mind also that erosion doesn't just happen in high rainfall events. It happens throughout the year. And in a high rainfall event, when an emergency spillway operates, the sediment retention pond is still operating. It's still got part of its function. But nobody can build a system big enough to go to an Auckland flood type event. But acknowledging that. That is one event. What these achieve, and it's exactly the same, you look up and down the roads as you drive around New Zealand, they've all got the same systems. And they are operating 99% of the time as designed. But as engineers, we ensure that you've got an emergency spillway. But the emergency spillways also have a really important function. We learned in the in the Auckland floods, the best way to do this, and there's some ongoing work happening, is you have a coordinated catchment system, right? And I think a coordinated catchment system ensures that the water that you're getting from your, you know what water you're getting from your neighbours. It's either coming out through a set of retention ponds, through the primary spillway, or you know that actually in a really big event, the emergency spillway is going to operate and the water's going to come here. I'm going to have a system in place to fund that directly to a drain.
So that's in this document as well, eh, Bunting?
Yeah.
So is that one of the mitigations to address the mitigation?
So Bunting's got multiple functions. Bun can be at the top of the paddock to stop the water entering the paddock. If you've got a massive catchment above you, you absolutely cannot control this enormous volume of water that comes onto your private land. So you'll have a bun or an interception drain at the top, and that's certainly what we learned in the major floods in Pukekohe late mid-90s, is that if water overtops because the drains become blocked, the coals become blocked, people can be lawful and throw their household rubbish into a council drain and blocks the culvert. Culvert then overtops, the water then flows into the paddock and it becomes uncontrolled and you're really in trouble. The bund that you refer to, of course, will stop that, will keep the water in the drain, or the intersection drain. And equally, at the bottom of the paddock, they have a role because they will direct the water to the
settling. Quite fundamentally settling ponds, isn't it, for most of the mitigation?
On a case by case basis, it's on their most appropriate, in their appropriate paddock. They are.
And so, with all these measures and ways to manage spillways and high rain events, this is all captured in the farm climate plan?
Yes. And I guess, we're referring to this document here. I might mention before, but these are things underpin the Farm Environment Plan, right? So we know we see there's one line in the checklist.
Mm.
One line in the checklist then becomes an action in the template. The action in the template is then built on documents like this. And the horticultural and agricultural sectors are really, I believe, proactive in developing these codes of practice. It's the industry way of doing it. It's a collection of knowledge and it's put together in documents like this. So we are all doing 10,000 different ways of trying to run trying to skin the cat. It is a really powerful tool in the whole system that collects information, creates knowledge and puts it into a document like this. It's being referred to as an environment.
And the uptake by the growers is good.
Absolutely. So you can, I think I refer to 70% corrected, 70% having environment plans, and again emphasising that, I mentioned this in the beginning, is that it is a system for staggering and planning the mitigation that you put in place. These center retention ponds aren't cheap things to install, but then equally losing your soil is more expensive. But again, the farm environment plans are really crucial in this, in that it creates a structure and a plan for implementing mitigation. So it might well be you'll see in that document 3 that there is a staggered implementation of the center retention ponds on this particular property. That's underpinned by documents like this that say if you are going to do it, then this is a standard that you need to do it.
Thank you. So could you produce this as an exhibit, this document?
Yes.
And so you mentioned the code of practice, which is referred to in your...
Sorry, this is, will be exhibit, what number are we up to? You said one was the 8, I suspect. I'm not sure I knew what the 7 was. No, not the 4
a little bit. I was going to you'll be familiar with this document too, which is about the soil and drainage management guide.
Correct, because that's produced as part of the planning and sustainability.
If I could just point it to a couple of matters in this document. And I note the code of practice that you referred to in your evidence, so that's one of the only evidence refers to this document, is that right?
Correct.
So if you could have a look at that document, please. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions around the foam walls. So that's page 1 through the 3rd page. Or rather known the overflow or spillway. I know we've covered that, but it's these overflow spillway discharges the excess water runoff in major storm events and stop barriers breaking. Select the position carefully to minimise the construction and later maintenance. And then have a list position the spillway, if possible, situate the spillway for firm undisturbed ground. And number 3 says ensure runoff discharges won't cause erosion. How did you expect that to be achieved?
Erosion sediment control is well, it's kind of well studied, and I said there's multiple ways of achieving that. Solid vegetated, and the water discharges onto a vegetated land. You'll see there's use of geotextiles in some situations. So the idea is, apart from the other thing, is rock discharging onto riprap. But the idea is that you don't have it, you know, and the water, which is incredibly powerful, cutting out. There's other ways as well, of course, that in these emergency spillways, is the flood level, right? So the flow over those spillways is an assumed flow. So again, that reduces the availability to use the geotextiles, possibly to use the spin into a beach at a time.
And so it grows on the ground, you support around.
Oh, I'm sure you can. You can drive around the area and like I tell on my great hero, I've been doing it for a while. The change is significant. Yeah, you can. In my mind, the example of the change was actually the Auckland floods, right? The Auckland floods were more than the floods in the coming of the year, but like the mid-90s when kicked off this sort of Francis Stone project was because of significant flooding and wash off. You didn't see that in the Auckland floods. And you didn't see that in the Auckland floods because we have significantly moved on as an industry in terms of erosion control. All these things we talked about in these companies' plans were evidently working in the Auckland flood, which I think is a perfect example. Look, we can learn more. Gosh, don't take lessons, right? From everything. There could be quite a bit of coordination, catchments, well-connected catchments and networks could probably be done better, and there's talk of the lots of that happening. So, the Auckland floods are a really, really good example on the ground of this stuff actually working.
Okay, so, would you produce this as an exhibit? Just
I'm more than happy to.
Do you have any idea what the date of this document
is? No, I saw that.
It refers to Cranklin District.
Yes, it does refer to
Cranklin and Environment Waikato.
Yes. It was produced as part of the Cranklin Sustainability Project. The Cranklin Sustainability Project was kind of the late 90s.
still in circulation, is it still being used?
Yeah. Look, nothing's new under the sun, right?
Oh, well, that's right.
This stuff is, the vegetable industry is well advanced on erosion and sediment control, and now, I believe, well advanced on nitrogen, like NRL2T. Also, don't forget, we're talking about erosion and sediment control, we're talking about phosphate as well. By far and away, the largest component of phosphate is attached to the sediment.
Thank you.
And
I have put this to Mr. Ford yesterday. You're familiar with this document? You have a copy of it? The court's got a copy. Just for the witness, thank you. So, just in terms of this document, I mean, it talks about benefits of a vegetative buffer strip, but the crucial evidence is depending on the circumstances. But on the buffer strip efficiency side of that page, in the second paragraph, it talks about the graph below demonstrates the key factors affecting a buffer strip, paddock slope, buffer slope. But then it goes down and says, but it is important to note that each site will have unique factors impacting the implementation of a buffer. So those are the factors that you've already been through, isn't it?
Yep, and that's a bit of a farm
environment. Absolutely. And so you might not know, but do you have any comment in relation to the figures on page 6? Annual costs, first year costs for maintenance?
I should have quite prepared this document.
You did?
So
are those pretty up to date? Are they?
Well, the year. Look, we're in a pretty high inflation environment, so I'm sure the growers attest that the costs of imports have risen significantly since this was prepared in 2011. To put it in context, the idea behind including the dollar values is none of this stuff comes for free, right? And both the implementation and the maintenance. So that's the content sitting behind that.
So I don't intend to go through anything further on this, but do you produce this as a specific?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Exhibit 11. You're saying that you're the author of this document, Dave?
Yes. While I held the pen, none of these code effects are developed in
Iceland. I understand that, but you have been directly involved in the
code. I have been directly involved.
Thank you.
And so I just had a couple of questions, and then I'll be done, and that's in relation to the documents you produced earlier this morning. And I guess I just wanted to really just look at the farm environment plan example and go to page 12 of that, please. Do you have a copy there? The farm environment plan example.
Is that 72 or is that where it's wrong?
This one?
The erosion sediment control plan.
Yes. Go down to page 12. Yes, so in the vegetated strip, buffer strip section, settling retention upon 2 is required to be 1%. As a catchment greater than 5 hectares.
Mm-hmm.
So then an alternative is to establish a 5 metre vegetation buffer along the bottom. The cultivated paddock would be seeped, set further back up the paddock and hedge-land, moving to the run between the new buffer and the cultivated buffer. I guess my question is, this buffer will take pressure off the existing undersized settling retention pond too, which could be retained to capture what isn't collected in the buffer. So does that suggest that actually in this instance a buffer and something else?
Well, actually, you made a very good point. That is exactly what that suggests. quite a unique situation in reality, and I know this property reasonably well. The SRP was increased in size. But when you prepare these sort of plans, right, you lay out the options. That was an option.
So that then is an option to use a buffer in conjunction with other measures?
Yeah, in all honesty, I don't think it wasn't the best option, and clearly it wasn't the option that was chosen. Again, those tools have So in that particular case there, it would have run through the meter above strip, and quite frankly, after that it could have been discharged out, but they already had a sediment retention pond in place. It wasn't big enough size, so why not run it through an SRP as well? Why not get to one? It was literally there. In reality, that grower didn't install the buffer strip, it just increased the size of that. But it's there. Why not?
Thank you, Mr. Barber. Thank you very much. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mike. We'll take a break, and I'll just inquire and see if there are others who have questions. Mr. Pennell, do you have any questions?
Just one, sure.
All right. Well, we'll take a break now.